South Korea's new president calls Pyongyang's weapons program a threat to global security and calls for the complete denuclearization of the North. Sri Lanka deploys thousands of troops to enforce a nationwide curfew one day after deadly protests over an unprecedented economic crisis. And the European Parliament establishes a committee to probe allegations that an Israeli spyware has been used by 50 nations for mass espionage. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. South Korea's new president wants the neighboring North to be completely denuclearized because its weapons pose a threat to global security. The newly inaugurated president, Yoon Suk-yeol, says the South is prepared to resolve this threat through dialogue. According to Yoon, Seoul is willing to offer an audacious plan to help boost the economy of North Korea if Pyongyang moves toward nuclear disarmament. Yoon made the remarks during his inauguration speech in Seoul. Tensions are high on the Korean Peninsula, with the North starting a new push to advance its nuclear and missile program. Pyongyang says its weapons act as a deterrent against U.S.-led threats in the region. From Seoul, our correspondent Jennifer Chang explains if North Korea is likely to trust the South, given their sour relations and the dismal experience of previous negotiations.
The speech today was clearly aimed at getting North Korea to completely and irreversibly denuclearize. And it was attended by a very high-level delegation from the U.S. with the second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff, Vice President Kamala Harris's husband, attending. It's really dismal. The North does not trust South Korea at all, the new president, anymore, because the South Koreans, they elected this new president just by 0.73 percentage points. And this new president, he said that he is going to bring tactical U.S. nuclear weapons to South Korea. That's a threat against North Korea. He also said he would preemptively attack North Korea if he thought North Korea was going to attack first with, say, a hypersonic missile. Well, experts say, how is he going to know that North Korea is going to do a suicidal thing by shooting off a hypersonic missile at South Korea? Many experts say that is not fitting for a presidential candidate to say something like that. He has a lot of controversy surrounding him. He's not even able to reorganize his government.
Moving on to Sri Lanka, where it has imposed a nationwide curfew after five people were killed in the latest wave of protests over an unprecedented economic crisis gripping the nation. The situation has been volatile in the country for weeks amid mostly peaceful protests. But violence flared Monday after supporters of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa were bussed into the capital, Colombo, and attacked protesters with sticks and clubs. Nearly 200 people were wounded in the violence. Rajapaksa later resigned, but even that failed to calm public anger. The military had to rescue him after protesters stormed his official residence overnight, with police firing tear gas and warning shots to push back the crowd. Thousands of troops and police are now deployed in Colombo to enforce the curfew. The protest began several weeks ago over an economic crisis unseen in Sri Lanka since its independence in 1948. In the Philippines, people have turned out to voice their opposition to the results of the presidential election. The demonstrators gathered outside of the election commission, claiming irregularities in the polls. The initial results show that the son of the late dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, has won by landslide. With over 95% of the ballots counted, the 64-year-old candidate has garnered almost 30 million votes, more than double that of his nearest rival, Vice President Lenny Robredo. The official results are expected towards the end of this month. 10 candidates have entered the race to succeed President Rodrigo Duterte. The European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry into allegations that an Israeli software has been used by 50 nations to spy on at least 50,000 individuals. EU lawmakers are furious that the European Commission is refusing to set up its own investigation. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary, point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madame Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Today marks the first anniversary of Israel's 11-day bloody bombardment of Gaza, which claimed the lives of more than 260 Palestinians and left the enclave in ruins. In the following report, we take a closer look at last year's devastating war on the besieged Palestinian territory.
Gaza left in ruins following 11 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Palestinian territory. Palestinians breathed a sigh of relief from Israeli attacks after a ceasefire came into force on May the 21st. Cities and towns were heavily pounded by Israeli artillery and warplanes, even at night. Horror and panic go on. Some call their loved ones' names. Others rush them to hospital. And many more grieving for their loved ones. This girl is crying as relatives are carrying the body of her 11-year-old brother, Hossein Hamad, to gravesite. At the same hospital, 6-year-old Suzy was reunited with her father. Suzy was rescued after she had been trapped for 7 hours under the ruins of their home. Her mother and 4 siblings lost their lives. The Israeli attacks took a heavy toll on civilians and caused widespread devastation. But life goes on. Fears of a new outbreak of conflict is there too, as tensions simmer from time to time over Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah denounces calls for the resistance movement's disarmament. Seyed Hassan Nasrallah says the group's opponents want to turn the upcoming parliamentary elections into a political war. Addressing a gathering in Beirut, Nasrallah rejected calls by some political actors for Hezbollah to be disarmed. He said those advocating disarmament want to sell the country to the U.S. and leave Lebanon exposed to Israel. The Hezbollah leader said those opposing the movement want Lebanon to forsake its most significant tool that can help the country drill national resources in its territorial waters. Nasrallah said resistance is ready to help the government extract offshore oil and gas resources, which can easily mitigate the ongoing economic crisis.
You have a resistance, a courageous resistance, a strong resistance, a capable resistance that can tell the enemy, which works day and night on drilling and removing all the natural resources in the disputed areas. We tell the enemy, if you prohibit Lebanon, then we'll prohibit you. Yes, we are capable of prohibiting the Israelis from drilling their natural resources. We have the courage, we have the strength, and we have the capabilities. And I assure you, and I guarantee this, not one single company would dare to come to Karish area or anywhere in the disputed area if Hezbollah declared a clear threat and a clear warning in this area.
Nasrallah stressed that those calling for disarming Hezbollah are ignorant of Israeli threats. He cited Israeli massacres in southern Lebanon, including a mass killing in the village of Hula in 1948. Nasrallah said the Lebanese people resorted to resistance, realizing that the government neglected its responsibility to protect them. He said the resistance secured southern Lebanon, brought self-confidence among the people, and defeated the traitor Israel. Nasrallah urged people to vote for the resistance group in the upcoming election, that there is no hope for resolving Lebanon's problems without Hezbollah. Versus chief negotiator in peace talks with Ukraine says the negotiations have not stopped and are being held remotely. Vladimir Medinsky also dismissed the possibility of in-person talks anytime soon, saying, quote, more specifics are needed for their resumption. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators last held face-to-face peace talks on March 29. Since then, they have been meeting by video link. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has set conditions for re-entering peace talks with Russia. They include the restoration of pre-war borders and the return of thousands of Ukrainian refugees evacuated to Russia. Moscow accuses Kyiv of stalling the talks and using reports of alleged atrocities committed by Russian troops to undermine negotiations. Russia's war on Ukraine started in late February to, quote, demilitarize and denazify the country. Kyiv and its Western allies say the offensive was unprovoked and unjustified. Germany is feeling the pinch of anti-Russian sanctions more than any European country. The German banking chief has warned that his country could face a wave of bankruptcies. That is while Germany is Europe's biggest economy. This raises the question, how much longer will the EU push for Russian sanctions when it's hurting EU economies like Germany?
Europe's largest economy, Germany, is going through a historic phase. Inflation rates have risen sharply, reaching a 40-year high, with soaring energy prices being the key driving force. According to the German Federal Statistics Agency, the Statist, consumer prices were about 7.5% higher in April compared to last year. Berlin also faces an imminent recession in case of a gas supply cut from Russia. The latest remarks by the chief executive officer of a major commercial bank in Germany have increased concerns inside the country. Manfred Knopf has warned that the energy supply in Germany is at risk, which may lead to the spread of bankruptcies in the country. Quoted by a German business newspaper, Knopf said the energy supply is at risk. Supply chains are breaking in addition to high inflation in the country. He also warned that bankruptcies in German markets are probably going to increase. According to the executive, almost a third of Germany's foreign trade has been impacted as well. Germany is facing soaring energy prices and a skyrocketing inflation due to the imposition of sanctions on Russia to pressure Moscow into ending the war in Ukraine. The measures mainly affected the financial sector and the supply of high-tech products. The real crisis in Germany lies in the Russian gas, on which it depends to a large extent. Berlin was one of the opponents within the EU to ban the import of Russian gas, but the scenario changed completely after it announced recently its readiness to accept an immediate ban on Russian oil and gas supplies. According to Forbes, Germany is one of the largest customers of Russian oil, and Berlin depends on a third of its Russian oil imports, 45% of its coal purchases, and 55% of its gas imports from Russia. Economists believe the immediate suspension of Russian energy imports would cause a severe recession in Germany.
The EU is not allowed to stop. This is what Washington ordered, and Washington orders the EU around. And the crazy situation right now is that Washington was never as powerful as it is today. This is especially funny since the American president is a weak president. So obviously somebody else is inserting this pressure into the EU from Washington, and I think that is the American deep state pushing Joe Biden and the EU, both of them. And as long as nobody stops this kind of power wielding, it will continue.
The U.S. and its Western allies chose the worst possible weapon to deter Russia from continuing the war in Ukraine, and that is economic sanctions. After all, Russia is the world's third largest producer of crude and the largest supplier of wheat. This could lead to a recession that would not only harm the EU economy, but would also impact the rest of the world.
The Russia-Ukraine war is not comparable to any other war in history due to its geoeconomic significance. Both Ukraine and Russia are leading exporters of commodities such as crude, natural gas, iron and steel, wheat and edible oils that have a direct impact on inflation levels in major world economies. The conflict pushed crude prices to over $130 per barrel. There were also price increases on wheat, edible oils, and other commodities. The unilateral sanctions of the West against Russia had the unintended consequence of exacerbated inflation in Europe, East Africa, and South Asia, which were the largest importers of Russian wheat and energy. Despite the detrimental effect of sanctions on global markets, the EU unveiled plans for a Russian oil embargo earlier this week. The measure is expected to come into force within 9 months, with the time frame varying for different petroleum products. But several EU nations, including Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, are seeking an exemption from the ban.
And of course, all these sanctions against Russia are completely unfair, unjustified, and for the first time, because we have 8th of May today, and for the first time since the Second World War, a German government is again siding with Nazis and again against Russia. And this really makes Moscow very angry, and the people too.
And that does it for World News.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, especially MKO terrorist organization, and said that he had advised all terrorist groups to return back to the ocean of the Iranian nation and stop acts of terror to satisfy their masters in the West or the East. In this episode, we are going to touch upon his stance on leftist and separatist groups. Stay tuned, please. Concurrent with the victory of the Russian Revolution of 1917 and coming to power of communist ideology in the country, leftist thoughts grew in many countries, particularly in the neighbors of Soviet Union, including Iran. Though the religious fabric of Iran and the sensitivity of the ruling system never led them to spread much among masses. Today Party was the most important organized group among the leftist groups which came to existence in Iran after the Second World War. This party was eradicated in two phases. First, after the assassination attempt against the Shah in Tehran University, and then in the post-1953 coup period. Thus, its leaders and advocates escaped or were tortured or executed. A few of them also turned into spies of the regime through the pressures and temptations of the Shah agents. In 1960s, due to the increase of partisan struggles inspired by the thoughts of Che Guevara, Mao and Castro, and closure of political climate in Iran, some youth and students started armed struggles against the Shah. They intended to spread armed and partisan struggles to the whole society a la China and Cuba to topple the regime. But the Shah regime was fully supported by the U.S. As a result, the members of such groups would soon be identified and repressed before taking any serious measure. These groups were totally destroyed in late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, the regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was in its most powerful days, thanks to the exorbitant oil revenues and relying on security and military support of the U.S. and allies. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini started his struggle against the Shah and the U.S. with trust in God and relying on people's all-out support. Millions of men and women from all walks of life answered positively to Imam Khomeini's call to show their opposition to the regime of Shah. Therefore, they poured to the streets and chanted anti-regime slogans. The Imam's all-encompassing umbrella had indeed covered all political parties and every social stratum. Thus, the Islamic Revolution triumphed in a few months to the bewilderment of all analysts. Without doubt, the key element in this victory was the unmatched personality of Imam Khomeini and his charismatic leadership. The course of the revolution left no choice for political parties but to join the masses even if they didn't believe in the ideology and ideals of the Imam and the people. This was the means for most of them to survive. The leftist groups had no belief in Islam, but had to join the people to survive. However, after the victory, they started to act as opposition and counter-revolutionary elements. They left no stone unturned to hurt the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini time and again advised them to return to the Islamic Revolution and the Iranian nation. But they insisted on their stubborn thoughts and were finally exterminated. The Imam writes in his testament, "My recommendation to the leftists, like communists and Fadaye Khalq partisans and other groups with leftist tendencies, is that without proper studying of ideologies and the ideology of Islam, with those who are well aware of ideologies, especially Islam, which motive has satisfied you to be inclined to the ideology, that has failed in the world today? And what has happened that you have become content with few isms, whose content is null with researchers? What has motivated you to intend to draw your country to the lap of the Soviet or China and to fight your nation in the name of love of two-day party or hatch plots to the benefit of foreigners against your country and oppressed masses? Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing leftist groups, writes in his testament, "You can see that since the onset of communism, its masqueraders have been the most dictatorial, the most power-seeking, and the most monopolist governments in the world. What nations were smashed and annihilated under the rule of the Soviet, claiming to support masses? The Russian nation, Muslims and non-Muslims, have been struggling with twitches under the pressure of the Communist Party and are denied any freedom and are living in suffocation worse than that of the world dictators. Stalin, who was one of the so-called bright figures of the party, we were witness to his coming and going and his protocols and aristocracy. Now that you, the Beagle, are sacrificing your life for that regime, the oppressed people of the Soviet and its satellites like Afghanistan are dying of their oppressions." Imam Khomeini continues to advise the leftist, "You who are claiming the advocacy of people, what crimes you have committed against these people wherever you could, as with the noble people of Amul, who you wrongly called your strong advocates and sent many of them deceptively to fight people and the government to be killed. You want to offer the Iranian oppressed and deprived nation to the Soviet dictatorship, and as you are doing this treason under the guise of Fadai-e Khalq and advocates of the deprived. The Tudeh party and its cohorts are doing this through conspiracy under the mask of supporting the Islamic Republic, while other groups are doing it through arms, terror, and blasts." Imam Khomeini writes in continuation, "I write as testament to you parties and groups, either those who are known as leftists or those who are feeding from and inspired by the West, or even those such as Democratic or Komole parties who take arms in the name of autonomy and advocacy of Kurds and Baluch, and have destroyed the deprived people of Kurdistan and other places, and prevent cultural, hygiene, and economic services and reconstruction by the government on those provinces to join the nation. Now that they have experienced that they have done nothing and cannot do anything but making the inhabitants miserable, so it is to their benefit and that of the nations and regions to assist the government and give up rebellion, serving the foreigners and betrayal of their country. They should embark on building the country and be sure that Islam is better for them than both the criminal Western Pole and the dictatorial Eastern Pole, and it will fulfill the humane wishes of people better."
The Spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, the Russian president has said that Russia's military operation was a preemptive move against future aggression. Now, sentiments were received warmly in the Russian capital at the Victory Day parade, but not in Ukraine, where fighting is raging, and not in the U.S., who is keen on keeping this war going. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the different dynamics involved in this war and where the future stands, especially the world economic standing. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us, activist and commentator Don DeBar, joins us from Westchester, New York, and we also have lawyer, writer, historian, and former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, who joins us from Geneva.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Alfred de Zayas, let me first start with you. We're looking at Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Basically, the way that the Russian President Vladimir Putin described it today, of which there were many descriptions in his view of why this special military operation happened, it was a preemptive move against what he called future aggression. He capitalized on that and said that Russia had to act, and I'm quoting him, because a large-scale offensive against the breakaway republics in the eastern Donbass region was being planned. Are you convinced by Vladimir Putin's explanation there?
Well, this information has been in the public domain already several weeks. We do know that Zelensky was committed to retake the Donbass by force, and evidently there was also a decision to attack sooner or later Crimea. Now, as a professor of international law and as a former rapporteur, I devoted one of my reports to the General Assembly on the right of self-determination of peoples. And I think it should be the function of the United Nations to conduct self-determination referenda in all countries where there is conflict. As a matter of fact, the realization of self-determination is a conflict prevention measure. And the war didn't start on the 24th of February 2022. You know as well as I do that the war started on the 22nd of February 2014, 8 years ago, at the coup d'etat against the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych. And there, of course, the West, NATO countries, the United States, my country of nationality, were deeply involved in the organization and in the financing of that coup d'etat. So you have here a problem of internationalization of this dispute. You have Ukraine being armed to the teeth since 2014, not since January or February 2022. So the resilience of the Ukrainian army and the fact that they have survived this long is a direct consequence of the enormous armaments that my country, the United States and the United Kingdom and other NATO countries have delivered to the Ukraine, and the logistical support, the intelligence support that has been given.
Okay, could I jump in and just make sure we understand you correctly here? Since you're saying that this is something that broke out in 2014, are we to conclude from what you just said there that you're saying that it's not, as you said, something that has happened since January in terms of arming Ukraine, but it has happened since 2014 up to this point, that has continued, which is why they were able to hold out? Is that what you're saying?
People say, well, you know, Putin is unsuccessful. He is failing in his attempt to overwhelm Ukraine. Well, he never intended to overwhelm Ukraine. He intended to render Ukraine no longer a military danger. That's why his focus primarily on destroying the military targets, the railroads.
Let me jump in then and bring Don DeBar. And Don DeBar, I'm mentioning what Putin said because he's explaining himself, and I think it's worth mentioning. And another quote by him, we saw the military infrastructure unfolding in Ukraine, hundreds of foreign advisors starting their work. There were regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries. The danger grew every day.
You know, let's get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about. And first of all, you know, I would venture to say that perhaps the war began even before 2014. Certainly, the preparations for the coup that took place over a few years prior to that were part of the same war. Planning is part of the war. It's also a war crime to plan a war, particularly one that's actualized. But I would say going back to the first time they crossed the Elbe with NATO after promising, in order to induce Russia to be the only of the four powers to abandon its occupation of Germany, even though it was the most horribly damaged party in the world, more horribly damaged than the United States, Britain, and France combined, and also in terms of body count, including the Jews that the Nazis killed. The Soviet Union lost almost 30 million people, okay? And people quibble over 6 million people or not in the Holocaust. Granting 6 million, that's five times as many people. The United States lost in the six figures numbers, okay? And so the Soviet Union abandoned its occupation of Germany on a promise that NATO would not fill that space up and come forward. And they are now at the borders of Russia inside the Soviet Union. They have the three Baltics. They have half of Ukraine. And just for a little scale here, the aid, quote unquote, the military assets that are being transferred to Ukraine just in the first 7 months of this year, what's being budgeted, the $33 million and the billion or the $13 or $14 billion that have been handed over, annualize out to about $80 billion. Russia's entire annual military budget is $65 billion for 2021. So we and also Germany and Britain and France and Italy are sending arms to Ukraine as well. That's on top of the numbers I just cited. So in terms of the scale of the threat that President Putin is referring to in terms of military infrastructure being set up, we're talking about something massive. And this is in the one area, the European theater of Russia. Their $65 billion also is part of their defense in the Eastern theater in Asia.
Well, Don DeBar, so again, great facts that you're stating here. Obviously, I'm guessing the NATO member countries, and in particular, the U.S., they're all aware of this, but the general public is not. And, of course, the long-term memory perhaps doesn't serve the whole world, which conveniently, I guess, they have shut down Russia's, for example, RT in particular, who obviously wants these types of facts to go out. And, of course, our station also, as we're broadcasting what you have said. So that becomes an information war in a sense. But what's amazing about this is that Putin is being demonized, Alfred Desaias, in the way that he is, because he has been called a war criminal. He has been called by the U.S. President Joe Biden, And I forgot the other way that he was
Steinmeier by the German president also.
Right. So is that something that I mean, I'm not trying to promote violence nor deaths or civilians being targeted. So putting that aside, is it correct to put him in that context as the U.S. president has?
Well, demonization of a rival is, of course, primarily for local consumption, since the United States and NATO are aggressors in so many countries. In order to sell it to the public, we are nominally a democratic country, and you have to indoctrinate people in hating the enemy. So we have unilaterally declared Russia and China to be our enemies. And as in George Orwell's 1984, there's something called hate week. Hate week is an exercise in hate. And that is organized and conducted by the government and by the government's proxies. And that is what we have been doing for many, many years. We have a problem here of having brainwashed a large swathe of the American public into hating Russia, into canceling Russian culture, canceling Anna Netrebko and Valery Gergiev, and canceling, Tchaikovsky concerts and all sorts of things. This is like in 2003 when we canceled the French and when we rebaptized French fries, freedom fries, etc. It's an enormous machinery of propaganda, and this information war actually works. The majority of the American population doesn't think like I do, or doesn't think like John Mearsheimer does, or like Stephen Kinzer does, or like Francis Boyle, or Dan Kovalik thinks, or Marjorie Cohn. The American public tends to think my country right or wrong, and we are by definition the good guys, and we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia, not only to the Ukraine. We want regime change in Russia.
That was my next question. I'm glad you brought that up because, they say that Biden, it was a slip, and they had to come and clean that up, so to speak, the damage that caused. But isn't that the ultimate intention, Don DeBar, when it comes to the U.S. intentions in Russia? Of course, they're going at it in terms of the economic strangulation as much as they can. At the same time, of course, militarily, they're trying to bring the Russian military to its knees. But ultimately, do you think that's their goal?
Well, that's been the goal since 1917. That's the longest running and most expensive project in human history that has been regime change in Russia, in the Soviet Union. From what Churchill, vowing that reporting that that Bolshevik baby needed to be suffocated in its crib, to the $1 trillion military, spending, I don't know, 10 trillion, 50 trillion between 1945 and last Tuesday, all geared to dominate Russia and China, to remove the impediments to the utilization by the people that own the United States and Europe and everything else that they could put their hands on, to have access to the resources, the mineral resources and the human resources, without another rival on the planet. That is their objective. They're very clear about it. Brzezinski was clear about it. He wrote about it. He said it on tape a million times. Kissinger, a lot lessers, including some of the clowns they have in power now. This past week, five or six that I saw on tape say, of members of Congress, said we are at war with Russia. They say that we are now. Biden says regime change. Some others have said that too, a little more credible. And if that's true, first of all, I'm in the middle of working on, we've been trying to organize people to write something to their member of Congress to say, make Biden stop or impeach him. We can't have a war with Russia. Nobody's interested in that. But the problem we have is this. I remember in 2018 when the shrink who used to be at Yale, who got fired for these kinds of antics, there were three or four or five, it ended up being 700 psychiatrists that signed a letter expressing their fear of Donald Trump because he was unhinged. And this was because of a phone call, a nighttime tweet that he made, making reference to North Korea, saying to Kim Jong-un, you know, yeah, you've got a button, but I've got a bigger one and mine works. They thought he was unhinged. This was an unnecessary risk of nuclear war. This guy here, who can't remember whether or not he put on pants, literally, you can see how addled he is, right, has us at Russia's border at war with Russia, pumping in as much money and equipment as Russia spends on its own.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Alfred Desaias, Alfred Desaias, when you see the amount of energy, money, backing, support that comes through the military door, not only by the U.S., but also by the NATO member countries, which many analysts say it's the pressure from the U.S. that is making them do that, because on the side, you have military manufacturers that are jumping up and down, obviously looking at their ticker, on Wall Street, seeing how much money is being made. But yet, when it comes to diplomacy, silence. As a former U.N. Special Rapporteur, what does that mean? How does that make you feel?
Well, it's clear that our geopolitical interest is full spectrum dominance. That's what we want. And we have to sell it to the American people. That we do through propaganda and double standards. But what's interesting is that we can make a 20-year war in Afghanistan, United States, United Kingdom, NATO countries, completely fail in obtaining what we claimed that we wanted. But of course, the military-industrial complex laughed all the way down to the back. Yep. I mean, it's the military-industrial complex that rules the United States. It is what you might call the deep state that is behind this war, and that is what prevents Zelensky from reaching a diplomatic solution, because he could have had a diplomatic solution in January, in February, in the first days of the war, and there have been negotiations nonstop with the Ukrainians and the Russians, and the solution was simply neutrality and no membership in NATO, and no further threatening with major, you know, missiles and heavy weapons next to the border of the Donbas and next to the border of Russia. That's what it's about. But of course, we in the United States don't get this information. You can get it in the internet if you proactively look for it.
Sure,
you
sure.
You have to look for it.
I have to ask you this, Don DeBar. It's a little bit outdated, but I'm really curious as to what your thoughts are when you either read, heard, or saw the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi going to Ukraine. I mean, she could have done a Skype. What was the reason behind her being there, other than the fact that, and this is just an opinion here, to make sure to give the support that Zelensky, I'm not too sure, was looking for from Nancy Pelosi, but to endorse the fact that he should keep on going with the war. God forbid that he might have thoughts about wanting to resolve this.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is speculate also, of course. But I mean, first of all, a deduction that I've made, that's all it is. But if you do a close review of every visit by people, you know, administration, congressional representatives, European officials, et cetera, to quote Kiev since the 26th or 27th of February, you're going to find out that you don't see a single active street scene without the, what do you call it, the debris of a matting, you know, of a superimposed figure. My theory is that Zelensky left Kiev around the 26th of February, along with, I know for a fact it was reported that both the NATO headquarters that was in Kiev and also the U.S. Embassy staff left and went first to Lviv, or Lviv as they call it now, and then to Warsaw within like 3-4 days. My theory is that Zelensky also went, and he's been there since then. If you look back at around the negotiations for the first meeting with the Russians, that he insisted that it be in Warsaw. The Russians were willing to meet in Ukraine over the border from Belarus. And so I think that these are, so the answer to your question would be, I think one of the objectives of sending Pelosi there is to provide the illusion that Zelensky hasn't left Ukraine. I think he has. And I think that that's something that people need to consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, since we're running quickly out of time here, Alfred Zayas, so you have the U.S. Close to $4 billion, if not a little bit more, just during the Biden presidency, looking for the $30 billion, which $20 billion will be the military assistance. And, of course, you have all the rest of the EU member states that have provided the military assistance on top of the sanctions. But then you have the news that comes out that says the ruble has become the best performing currency. Or when you have 10 EU countries that are quietly buying Russian gas, oil, of course, that could be replaced. At the same time, you have record sales coming through because of the high price of gas for Russia. They are not obviously getting the results that they wanted with these sanctions, and of course with all that military assistance. So, doesn't that show that that's not going to work? That the Russia's money wheel is going to keep turning because obviously the sanctions have not had the impact, the intended impact that they wanted.
Well, I'm not even sure that they intended that. I mean, we live in a make-believe world. We know that sanctions do not work. Sanctions against Cuba have not worked in 61 years. Sanctions against Nicaragua in 42. Sanctions against Venezuela in 22 years. They have not induced a regime change. But we have to somehow show that we are strong and that we are defending our values and that we have a mission to bring democracy to Russia. And of course, sanctions, even if it leads to serial bankruptcies in Germany, in France, in the United Kingdom, it is the German businessman, it is the German industrialist who's losing money and tons of it because of these sanctions. The whole thing is sick. But again, you remember in Orwell's 1984, you have newspeak and you have doublethink and you have cognitive dissonance. Uh-huh. And you can believe at the same time that the sanctions will have some effect, even though empirically, they're going to hurt you more than Russia.
Well, this is the part that is very confusing. Don DeBar, maybe you can clarify it for us. What would a win look like for either side, actually? What would winning look like for the U.S. When it comes to what it wants? Because it can't, obviously, based on just too many analysis that's been made, be able to push the Russian forces out of Ukraine. I mean, I'm looking at some of the stats here, 900,000 active personnel and 2 million reservists that Russia has, and also these are the favorable positions that it has in the east along with the air power. So what would a win look like for the U.S.? And at the same time, let's not leave Russia out of this. You know, what would a win for Russia look like? Because reports indicate that they have suffered massively when it comes to soldiers' lives and also equipment.
First of all, I don't believe the reports that are from here that they've had massive losses. But whatever that it is. I'll answer about Russia first because it's short. It's a shorter answer. A win for Russia is basically a pushback of the threat, the immediate threat to their security. That would be a withdrawal. I mean, they've been clear about what they want, a withdrawal of NATO forces. It really should go back to the other side of the Elbe River in Germany. But certainly the border countries should be neutralized, sort of a Finlandization, as the term is used now by some who hold themselves out as historians. And the abatement of the threat. For the United States, their goal, their objective is regime change in Russia. President Putin made clear that there will be no regime change in Russia, having nothing to do with his personal presidency, but the Russian government was elected by the Russian people. They will choose their own form of government, and they have the weapons to defend themselves if there's a threat to an actual threat that happens to their security with respect to that, and they intend to use them. So what an American victory looks like, or the outcome, is either they accomplish regime change or there's a new art form around the world on the order of what they call Hiroshima's shadows, only in cities across the United States and Europe and all over the world, okay. Which is too horrible to imagine, but is very close to happening.
30 seconds to you, Alfred Desaias, in conclusion. This is a world conflict now. You have shortages of energy. You have shortages of food. You have IMF sounding off the alarm in Africa in terms of food insecurity. There'll be social unrest. Countries around the world are suffering from either wheat, energy I mentioned, inflation, recession. Isn't this madness?
It is total madness, and it was predictable, and it was preventable because the proposals that Putin put on the table in December, which I read, were entirely moderate. And all he wanted was an European security architecture that would protect the rights of everybody, including Ukrainians and Russians. But the Americans didn't want that.
Okay.
I mean, it's been on our agenda change in Russia.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. That was Alfred Desaias, lawyer, writer, historian, and former U.N. Special Rapporteur. Don DeBar, thank you so much. Activist and commentator from Westchester, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavli, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Today, almost all propaganda operations in the mass media run by Eastern and Western blocs write or speak against the Islamic Republic. The reason is clear. The Islamic Republic plans to preserve its independence and curtail the hands of world devourers and their affiliates from this country. The Islamic Republic wishes all Islamic countries and all the governments dominating Islamic countries to wake up from their deep slumber.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In his speech, Imam Khomeini has said that it is our duty today to be ready to withstand and endure any pain in our opposition to dangers that threaten Islam and the Muslims.